welcome to Trent Voices, the Trent University Alumni Affairs show on Trent Radio. I'm your host, Donald Fraser of Alumni Affairs. It is Tuesday, February the 2nd, and this is episode 27. Stuart Wheeler is Canada's ambassador to Iceland, which itself is a pretty nifty career position, but Stuart has had a lifetime of rich and fascinating career experiences. He worked in the Public Information Office at the House of Commons and then joined External Relations in International Trade Canada, where he worked in Washington, as well as head of PR at the High Commission in London. He went on to be political program manager for the Canadian Embassy in Afghanistan. And if that weren't enough, he's gone on to have some pretty cool communications and public relations gigs at the House of Commons and been press secretary to Governor General Adrian Clarkson. He earned the Minister's Award for Foreign Policy Excellence as a member of the Kosovo Force in 1999 and was awarded the Queen Elizabeth II Golden Jubilee Medal in 2002. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm honored to welcome Ambassador Stuart Wheeler to Trent Voices. Stuart, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Great to meet you, Donald. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. You've come a long way.
Well, it's really great to be back. I've just toured the campus, and so much has changed in 25 years. I was back here with my partner to visit for the 40th anniversary, and I remember doing a tour then, and the Indigenous people's Hall of Learning was new then, and Zoski College, and but there's been lots of new and exciting things happening at Trent, but it's still got the same core feel to it, and wandering the halls a little bit at here at Champlain College and at LEC, where I spent a long and wonderful time in the 80s and 90s. It seems like it was just yesterday, but it's 25 years ago, and it's great to be back.
I'm of a similar vintage to you, and working at Alumni House and wandering around campus, I keep expecting to see people that I went to class with coming around the corner. It's that kind of feeling of familiarity. I'm actually going to start off because your former boss, when you were back at Trent and working in the pool at the athletics complex, Sue looks back at your time and said you spent a number of hours in the cool pool at Trent University. She says, you know, the freezing cold conditions probably, you know, set you up for prepared you for time in Iceland.
Well, absolutely, Sue Robinson. She was the head of aquatics and my boss for a number of years working at the pool. And I remember many cool mornings waking up before dawn and going over to the pool to lifeguard the morning swims. And you know, when you get out of the pool and your hair is wet and you're rushing to get back for breakfast and get off to your first class, there's certainly a sort of memories of many cold mornings. What's fascinating in Iceland is Iceland, as many people know, is a sort of geothermal hotspot, and and so prides itself in its network of spas and pools all around the country. But all of them are outdoor.
Yeah.
So here you are, you know, at -5, the snow is falling, wind is howling, and you're sitting outside in a hot tub or swimming lengths in a regular pool. And I remember first arriving there. We got to Iceland about 3.5 years ago, and going to the pool, and as the winter settled in, you know, thinking as I walked out of the change rooms, wet onto an icy pool deck, thinking, "Wow, okay, the cool pool at Trent was not that cold. This is this is pretty cold." But then you get into this Nordic cycle of going between hot water and cold water, and it's really healthy. And now I'm at the pool 3 times a week.
I was going to wrap up with this, but we might as well. I mean, we're in Iceland now, conversationally. So, you know, just a bit of the trivial side of Iceland. I mean, it's a northern nation, and as a northern nation, it shares a lot of similarities to Canada. But in a lot of ways, the landscape that you mentioned, the food, the culture is really unique, really, really different. As a Canadian, how do you find Icelandic life?
Oh, we love life in Iceland. It's a great place to be, and it's a great place to be the Canadian ambassador. Iceland, as you say, culturally is very different. Has a long history that they're very aware of. They know who they are as a people, and that really drives them as a society. And I'm going to talk about a little bit about that in my talk tonight. But what is interesting when you compare it with Canada, and so I spend a lot of my time making links between Canada and Iceland and promoting those, and Canada's exactly 100 times bigger than Iceland.
Okay.
And we have exactly 100 times more population. So the density of people to land is almost the same. So when you're in Iceland, it doesn't feel much different than Canada. Cooler summers, and surprisingly milder winters. We never get as cold as in Canada. So the people, their sort of relation to geography and space, and letting people be people, their connection to the land, to getting out on the land, to hiking, to enjoying summer houses and getting away from the city. You know, 2/3 of their population is in one city in the south of the country, and then the rest of the country is sparsely populated remote communities. I mean, does it sound like anywhere else you'd know? Yeah. I mean, you could replicate that 100 times across Canada. So as a Canadian, it feels very similar. Yeah. Yet the cultural differences are very rich, and so for a small population of only 300,000 people, an incredibly vibrant music, arts, literature scene. Canadians do very well there. There's a real historic connection to Canada that I think Canadians don't know very much about, but every Icelander does. In the late 1800s, from 1875 to 1905. There was a famine in the north of Iceland, north and east of Iceland, after a major volcanic eruption in the 1870s, and which drove waves of emigration out of Iceland. Hmm. And it was really the first time that Iceland in more than 1,000 years had had an out migration, or a serious one. And during those 25 years, about 1/3 of the population left.
Wow.
And they all went to Gimli, Manitoba.
Huh.
And they started in Gimli and then spread out across North America. And today, the estimate is somewhere between 200 and 250,000 Canadians of Icelandic descent. Mm-hmm. And there are only 300,000 Icelanders.
Hmm.
So what they call Vestustindikur, the Western Icelanders, yeah, are part of their psyche, their national sense of self and society. I mean, it's as if Canada had, imagine we have some kind of economic dislocation, mm-hmm, and 10 million Canadians move to Peru.
Yeah.
Well, in 100 years, that spot in Peru is going to have a huge space in the Canadian psyche, because every third person in the country is going to be related to somebody,
yeah,
in Peru. Well, so when I'm walking down the street in Reykjavik, and people find out that I'm a Canadian ambassador, they literally stop me and ask me, do you know my cousin in Gimli? And you think that that's just a joke,
yeah,
but they all have cousins somewhere in Canada.
Well, I mean, and there's always the big joke whenever you say you're from Canada and another country. Oh, do you know Joe from, yeah, Saskatoon or whatever? In this case, it's actually embedded into,
absolutely,
the culture. How much time as an ambassador do you spend making those links between not just the Icelandic people in Manitoba,
right,
but that Icelandic diaspora that's across Canada? How much time do you spend bringing that notion back to Iceland?
Well, it's a bit of both. I think the cultural connections are sort of the bedrock of the relationship. Mm-hmm. But modern Canada-Iceland relations are about a whole lot more.
Yeah.
We're neighbors in the Arctic. The Arctic has really been a focus of my time there, not just because of personal connections to the north in Canada, but because the Arctic has been such a priority for the Canadian government. And in the last few years, we were in the chair of the Arctic Council. So as a Canadian ambassador in an Arctic capital during that time, there was a lot of engagement and conferences and speaking and moving things along, initiatives that we were doing a lot, particularly in collaboration with Iceland. When I get out and about in Iceland, and I try and travel as much as I can, you know, there's a tendency sometimes, when you're posted to a foreign capital to stay in the capital, and that you could, you know, fill your day. I mean, I think we all have busy lives and busy jobs, and you could certainly fill your time, staying in Reykjavik. But everybody who's in Reykjavik, even though 2/3 of the country lives in greater Reykjavik, they all have family roots, or they come from somewhere else in the country. It's like people in big metropolises in Canada. They may live in Ottawa, Montreal, Toronto, Vancouver, but scratch the surface, they come from somewhere else, or their family comes from somewhere else. So you really need to get out and get to know the country in order to understand what's going on in Iceland and in Icelandic politics and in Icelandic economics and in how they approach things. They've got a really interesting approach to Arctic research. Their big center for Arctic research is not the national university in the capital, which is the biggest university in the country. It's a small university in the north of the country, in the second biggest city. And believe it or not, the second biggest city in Iceland only has 18,000 people. But Akureyri in the north has a university. It has the secretariat of two working groups of the Arctic Council. It has the Stephenson Arctic Institute. It has a whole bunch of sort of think tanks and private public sector organizations and companies that have sprung up in the 25 years that young university has been there, and so there's a real sort of focus of northern studies and northern activity in the northern part of the country. So I try and get there 4 or 5 times a year.
It's interesting because you bring up the policy aspect, and you know, international policy when you're dealing with the Arctic, which is a strong background for you. You bring up education. I know that you've had ambassadorial roles when it comes to education, like when you were in Bogota, but that you also talk about the importance of getting out and meeting Icelandic people. We take ambassadors or the role of ambassadors for granted. We all know that Canada has ambassadors to all these wonderful nations, but most people really don't wrap their head around what an ambassador's role is. And take us through a day in the life of the ambassador, Canadian ambassador.
Canadian ambassador in Iceland. Well, it's never the same one day to the next. Iceland, our embassy in Iceland is pretty small. We're what we call a classic micro mission. I'm the only Canadian in the office, 3 local Icelandic staff. But I've been able to supplement that with bringing interns both from Canada and from Icelandic universities that we're doing a lot of work partnering between research institutions, Canada and Iceland. So taking advantage of that and multiplying our numbers. I spend probably, as I say, a lot of time has been spent on Arctic, so that would be attending conferences at the university and speaking. I'll be speaking at a conference in March on Iceland in the Arctic. The other big priority is commercial relations. Canada Iceland trade is growing. We have a free trade agreement between Canada and Iceland, which ironically was signed and brought into force after the big banking crisis in Iceland. It's only been in effect since 2009, and now is really the last few years has been the time when both the Canadian economy has been, did pretty well through the recession compared to many countries around the world, and Iceland suffered tremendously when all 3 of their national banks collapsed. 70% of the the country's small businesses went bankrupt, and you know, it was a huge economic turmoil. And then, but they've really taken advantage of their reputation as a green, eco-friendly, exciting, off the beaten track place to attract the world to come and explore Iceland. I think people are looking for those kinds of experiences these days, and so tourism has taken off and has got their economy back on track. So we're doing a lot. We implemented an open skies agreement between Canada and Iceland in 2013. And when I first arrived, there were, in the summer, at the height of summer tourist season, there were 6 flights a week from Canada, three each from Toronto and Halifax. And the Toronto flights were year-round. This summer, we're expecting 38 flights a week. And it's just been growing leaps and bounds, and that brings businesses and people and institutions into connections. And so what I try and do is engage. You know, we're such a small embassy. We've got to be careful not to be stretched in too many directions. Okay. So I try we try and focus on certain sectors of the economy where we're trying to create links. So the fisheries and innovation sector on the blue biosphere in the ocean sector. We're in Nova Scotia and Newfoundland. There's a lot of interest and connections with the Icelandic fishery, and in sustainable approaches to making sure that we're maximizing the catches that we're landing. Canada has a lot to learn from Iceland in that respect. On the energy side, renewable energy, geothermal energy, hydro. Iceland is 100% renewable energy user and producer. They only import fuel for vehicles, which they're working on electrifying. So there's a lot that can be done in those sectors. And then there's a really exciting high-tech gaming startup entrepreneur kind of scene, and they're making strategic alliances through universities and startup incubators with Halifax, with Montreal, Toronto, Edmonton, which is also where the flights are taking people. So it's interesting to you know, whether it's meeting with companies, hosting Canadian groups that are visiting, putting together programs for a visiting minister from a province, a visiting minister from the federal government, and then there's of course the basic political relations which exist between any two countries. And so if Canada is engaged on a human rights issue at the UN, then I'll be instructed to go in to the foreign ministry and make our case on whatever our resolution is on the human rights in Iran, for example, which is an annual campaign we do at the UN. The UN is an area where Iceland is doing really interesting things on gender. So I try and look at areas where Iceland's doing interesting work, where Canada's doing interesting work, and where together we can do things on the international stage.
And it's interesting. I mean, you bring up something like Iran, and you look at the varied nature of your career. Right now, you are in a very dynamic, cutting edge country when it comes to technology, when it comes to culture. Not too long ago, though, you were stationed in Afghanistan. So it's completely on its head. What prepares you for that role, to be able to shift gears from a war-torn area like Kabul and then going into something like Iceland?
Yeah.
How do you wrap your head around these different roles?
I guess that's one of the things I love about the Foreign Service. You know, I'm passionate about Canada and about Canada's place in the world and about what's going on in the world. But I don't think I would want to go to the same office, work for the same organization or the same job for my entire life. You know, before I came to Trent, I had very clear ideas that I wanted to study biology and become a doctor and follow my father's footsteps. And then I went on a high school exchange corresponding, pen pals, and we used to write letters in those days, with a friend from Ottawa who was here at Trent in the TIP program. And she said, if you're liking your time over in Norway, you should come to Trent. And there's this great international program, and you can, you know, meet people from all around the world. Because I was telling her about how cool it was to live abroad and live in a place and speak a different language. And so I thought about coming to Trent and coming here and doing international studies, and then doing a third year abroad in Spain really cemented my decision early on to change that idea that it would be interesting to be out there in the world doing interesting things and going to different places. And then when you think about what organizations, or at least 25 years ago, I could have looked at international NGOs or think tanks and development work, which was very fascinating, and I would have liked that. But I guess the idea of representing your own country abroad seemed to me the pinnacle of what I could want to do if I was going to work in government somehow. Mm-hmm. I didn't really see myself working in the private sector. If you know, you're committed to doing something for the public good, frankly, I'd rather be pushing paper around the world somewhere in a far-flung place than in Ottawa. And getting back to your question about what prepares you then to move and pick up gears and shift, or pick up everything and shift gears every 3 or 4 years. I guess it's sort of impatience or curiosity or a little bit of ADHD. I don't know what it is, but I love the idea that every 2 or 3 years I'm going to be up against a huge learning challenge.
Yeah.
And I'll have 6 months to read into a new job when I find out where I'm going next. And then you sort of devour as much as you can, reading nonfiction, obviously, about the place you're going to and learning their history and what's going on in that place, but also trying to read some literature and get a sense of the people that are there. Try and learn the language if you can. When I went to Afghanistan, I was very lucky. I had a month of intensive Dari training so that... I think it's really important when we're out in the world as a representative of the country and a representative of Canadian people that you make a good first impression. And being able to do that in someone's own language and respecting their culture was a really big part of I think, Canada's success in a place like Afghanistan, where it's so crazy and things are so difficult and you're meeting such amazing people who are trying to put their country back together. So you just pour yourself into getting up that learning curve. The work is fascinating. A place like Afghanistan, it was challenging. I'd had a posting, as you mentioned, in Bogota, Colombia, previously, and I'd spent 2 years there working on the peace process and, human rights situation. I used to think that that the Colombian situation, with 40 years of civil war and narco drug situation, and was complicated, and that this was, you know, the most complex kind of challenge in governance that I'd ever seen, and trying to figure out how they would get out of this this cycle of violence. And working with some great people, working with other countries, we worked a lot with the Scandinavians, the Norwegians, the Swedes, with the Dutch, with the British, obviously the American partners, and we used to say that that doesn't matter how much you study Colombia, every week you spend in Colombia, you learn more. Mm-hmm. And every time you learn something new about Colombia, you realize how little you know. And so every week was an exercise in realizing how ignorant you were about what was really going on in Colombia. And so I came to Afghanistan thinking, okay, long time war, drug situation, international crisis, many people involved. You know, I'm going to be able to apply some of what I've learned in Colombia, in Afghanistan. And I got to say, Colombia seemed to be an organized, perfectly run little democracy when I think back from when I was in Afghanistan. So it was a good training ground, actually. And I've tried to do that in my career. I sort of go back and forth between this this desire to be out in the field, really on the cutting edge of where conflict and post-conflict situations are putting countries and societies in difficult situations, and then interspersing that with postings in developed countries where Canada has very advanced relations and where we're really, those are our allies in mm-hmm. the difficult spots. But you need to get to know them in their home countries too. So I've had postings in Washington and London and now in Iceland.
We've only got about 2 minutes because you've got a room. People are waiting to celebrate you and your visit here with a wonderful lunch. But before you go, it's interesting because you bring up the importance of learning in this whole lifelong learning when you're parachuting into all these different cultures. You also talk about the importance of first impressions. And I take a look at your job titles, your history of employment, spokesperson, press secretary, counselor, ambassador, and I see a theme that runs through it. And that theme is one of communication, going both ways. And while we have you here at Trent University, I've got to ask how that Trent experience, how your Trent education helped inform your ability to act as a communicator.
Well, I used to when you leave Trent, I think you become a lifelong ambassador for the institution, and I used to compare sort of my experience here to all of my friends who graduated from big universities all around North America or the world, and really it was this small group teaching seminar taught environment where you were put on the spot and you had to. You know, defend your ideas and talk through things. You weren't just sitting in a big lecture hall taking notes. Mm-hmm. And that plus then going abroad and being forced to learn in a very different cultural environment.
Yeah.
I think that as part of the Trent experience really prepared me then for a life of being the connector and communicator and trying to find ways to help Canada speak to the world and the world to speak to Canadians.
I know that you are going to be acting as a communicator today and for the rest of your visit at Trent University. There are students, there are faculty, there are community members all waiting to get to know you, and I've had a wonderful chance to. So I'm going to share you now with everyone else. Stuart, thank you very much for being here today.
No, thanks, Donald. It's been real pleasure, and I'm glad to be back at Trent. It's hard to believe after 25 years, but it feels like coming home.
Enjoy your visit.
Thank you.
That was Stuart Wheeler, the ambassador to Iceland, the Canadian ambassador to Iceland. Once again, I'm Donald Fraser of Trent University's Alumni Affairs. This has been Trent Voices, and we'll see you next week.